Okay, so I'm here with Maggie Estep, who is most recently the author of Alice Fantastic. Maggie, how are you doing?
I'm good right now. I'm full of food and very happy.
Oh, that's good to be happy.
Yes.
I mean, it's fantastic that you're happy.
It is fantastic, conveniently enough.
I want to start this conversation in a sort of animalistic vein, because animals have been a constant theme throughout your work.
Yes.
And in this, we have, a mother who has 17 dogs. The exact same number, matching prepubescent and premature maturity and all that. And so I must ask you, what's with the animals? I mean, why the constant interest? And of course, we have Eloise, who likes to make stuffed animals.
Yeah,
exactly. So, what is the animalistic affinity?
It's really, unfortunately, very straightforward that I come from a family of people who's. And there's a good line. I was reading from my book last night at a reading, and I read this line and thought, this is good. This describes it well. And this is true of my family. Our love of animals is directly proportionate to our indifference to human beings.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit of an exaggeration, but I grew up around all kinds of horses and cows and dogs. And in fact, to this day, my mom, if I want to get her talking to me for more than 2 minutes, it has to be about the dogs. So it's sort of an off-the-nose dialogue where we're talking about the dogs, but really we're talking about something else.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah.
And in this, you are talking about something else with the dogs, because there's from the very beginning, the big oaf with the puppy and all this, reminding me very much of Lenny of Mice and Men, among many other literary allusions. I first of all want to ask if some of these literary allusions that are there, the Rocking Horse Winner, for example, were these intentional, or were these just part of the whole animal conjuring?
No, it's never deliberate. It's just all there swimming around in my little brain and comes out inadvertently sometimes.
Little brain. I want to ask you about littleness, because one thing that was very curious is that many of the women in this book are described as tiny.
Oh.
You have the tiny goth girl waitress. You have...
Oh, yeah.
Eloise is described as tiny by her mother.
Yeah.
And of course, Kimberly is described as tiny.
Yeah.
And of course, there's Tina in this.
Yeah.
Tiny Tina. I'm getting a little theme here that most of the women in this book are tiny, and I'm curious as to why this is. What is it with this modifier here?
I actually had not really thought of that. I don't know. But Alice, the main one, is not... She's rangy.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. There's something actually about small women who are very tough that's really, kind of a beautiful prototype. Mm. Yeah, until you pointed it out, I didn't realize that was going on in this book, but...
There's an inverse ratio to height and toughness in your mind? Is that
maybe, your theory?
Maybe,
yeah, that might be something, yeah.
Okay. Did you develop this theory over the course of time, or did it just apply to the
universe
of this stuff?
It just came out at this very moment.
Okay. I don't want to give anything away, but I must point to the reverse symmetry, the yin-yang, as it were, of one character being kicked out of bed at 6 in the morning, and another character essentially kicking someone else out of bed at a time. Deliberate symmetry on your part? Does symmetry help you find this the way different people deal with... And why all this kicking out of bed? personal trauma? Bad experience? I don't know.
They're all very impatient characters, as the book sets out, and not very tolerant of much. And I think by the end of the book, a few of them learn to actually stay in bed with whoever they're in bed with for longer than necessary. So I think that sort of shows a character's development when they're to show them first off, kicking or being kicked out of bed very promptly, and then later being able to sustain it a little more.
Yeah. The MO is to have these characters stay in bed. This is the way that they are grounded, so to speak.
Yes.
I must ask you also about, and again, I'm trying not to give anything away, but it seems to me that there must always be a mother of some kind, no matter what happens to all of the characters. Was this planned from the get-go, the notion of a constant mother figure throughout?
No. Nothing is consciously planned. You know, I it's complete. All my books are completely. I hear. I hear the characters screaming in my head. I start writing and they kind of dictate everything.
Yeah.
And then I go back and think, oh, look at that thread. So no, it wasn't planned, the mother thing, no.
Interesting, because, I mean, I was going to ask you, it seemed criminal
yeah.
for you to introduce this interesting character who is managing Alice's money, only to have, and wants to get into her pants,
yeah.
only to have her disappear and not appear again.
I
felt really, really sad about that.
That was criminal. That was, I kind of realized at the end of the book, oh, I just let her go. She did have a much bigger part, and it wasn't quite working.
Ah, okay.
And so I X'd out that bigger part, but then I never really resolved that character, huh. I must admit.
Is it how the character works within the narrative or your own particular interest in that particular character that dictates
it's
the
both.
Longevity?
It's more how they work within the narrative. Because interest, I mean, I would just go off on so many tangents with so many characters.
Yeah.
But then I have to rein it in. You know, I write and write and write and then chop, chop, chop.
I'm curious how much you do rate it. I mean, what was the original? Do you have like some sort of mammoth draft that you have to cut down with a cleaver or what?
Not a cleaver. This one was pretty clean. This one came out, I'd say I reduced it by only about a half. Mm-hmm. And kind of as I went along in for some of it. When I'm starting a new book, the first 100 or so pages, I keep going back and chopping and chopping and chopping, and then I really have the flow, and then I go to the end, and then I chop some more.
Hmm. Now, in terms of planning, it seems like you don't plan if these characters
are... I don't plan, no.
Oh, okay.
I'm trying to now because I have something that... I'm writing something set in 1872 where I kind of do need to know where they're going to end up.
Yeah.
And I kind of know where they're going to end up, but I have to do a tiny bit more planning and even plotting than is what I'm used to.
I'm also curious about this reining in impulse you were describing earlier, whether it's not necessarily pertaining just to getting the book tight and clean, but also to the imaginative wandering fancies that these characters will end up going into. I mean, to what extent do you have to rein in your general sense of how human beings operate?
I have to rein it in a little, and because already people seem to read a lot of my books and characters and think that they don't resemble anyone they know in their lives. To me, these are very ordinary people that I encounter all the time, but they're not to some people. I get accused of deliberately being shocking and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That is completely not my intent, and I would never have thought that.
Is this why you have to have really astute observations? Like, for example, the cab drivers who seem to always have someone to talk with after midnight, which I was like, yeah, that's totally dead on. I mean, that's an absolute observation that is very real.
Uh-huh.
Something like that, throw that in there to kind of just sort of say, look, I'm grounded in a little bit in reality.
Yeah,
here.
Okay. Yeah.
Does such an observation along those lines come later when you're in the process of editing or
No, that comes right off the bat, usually.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's something that comes often when you are trying to, when you're sort of conscious of being a little out there in terms of like where your characters are going? Or
I don't think so. I don't think so. I think that's kind of organic, my little... Because as I go about my daily life and my dull routines and things, I am making notes of that about cab drivers having someone to talk to after midnight, or that's what I'm doing all day long, every day, everywhere I go. And then they can all come out.
So you're holding on a whole bunch of notebooks now with observations that you're just waiting to unload in various books. How many observations are you holding?
I don't know. There are millions probably, but I don't even know they're there until. Suddenly there's a spot for one.
Oh, okay. These are all floating around in your head, or are they actually chronicled somewhere?
No, they're all in my head.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sometimes they're chron. And there's certain... Sometimes I'll repeat a line throughout this, through like five different books or something. And
I was also curious, speaking of lines, that you sometimes have cliches pop up within the lines, like take a rain check and the like. It's funny, this unfortunately says probably more about me than you, so I blame me for this, but the thing about take a rain check is I had a conversation with someone about whether take a rain check is belongs to a certain kind of generation. You don't see like kids in their 20s
saying this, but
you do see a character who's in her 30s actually say something like that. So I found that to be interesting. I mean, I'm curious how much you are concerned with idioms and putting them into dialogue like this, because you even have Eloise at times take apart the idioms and try to sort of make sense of them.
It's kind of a fun thing, and I work right now. I'm teaching writing to teenagers in a rehab, and so I'm just soaking up their idioms and their whole but what's great is trotting out take a rain check or some thing that only someone in their 30s or 40s would know, and they go, what did you say? And they've never heard it. It's and they're all curious about it.
You've got a laboratory here.
Yeah, I really do. In so many ways, actually. Yeah.
Well, like what ways? Describe how you have the laboratory here aside from.
Well, a lot of them have. They think differently. I mean, and it's not just a generational thing. It's a lot, most of them are poor and come from like pretty extreme poverty situations and violence and stuff. And they've just developed these survival mechanisms that are fantastical, you know. And I'm having them write, and so they come up with all this stuff that's pretty inspiring.
Well, what kind of stuff do you have them write? I mean, do you have them draw from their personal lives, or I'm just curious.
Sometimes I say that they have to do that, but most of the time they don't want to. I mean, they come from pretty fucked up, you know. Some of them really, they do not want to be thinking about their family, what's left of their family or whatever. So if I am having them draw from their personal lives, I have to be really careful to say, you know, something pretty good, because they'll you know, I don't want to like traumatize them and have them remember something hideous. So sometimes, but oftentimes I have them make up fairy tales or write a commercial or, you know, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. Well, this actually leads me to wonder if you are taking millions of observations from regular life.
Yeah.
We get into an ethical debate. I've had this debate a number of times, but I'm curious about what your position is on this.
Yeah.
To what extent do you take from life, and to what extent is a novel an art of creating or an art of taking completely fabricated behavior? I mean, to what degree do you feel that you must be verisimilitudinous? To what degree do you feel that you have to be completely inventive and make shit up?
It just always has to be emotionally true for me. So it has to be something that I've felt or someone I'm very close to has felt and done generally. Although now writing about, you know, a different time period, I had to like spend all this time with these characters who lived in 1872 in my head for like the last 10 years until to the point where I could be emotionally genuine with someone who lived in 1872. I don't know. Does that answer the question?
It does. But 10 years, really.
Yeah.
You have to
12
really,
or something, yeah.
You have to really pretend to be in 1872 for 10 years in order to write about it.
They've just been rolling around in my head, and I think, you know, I go somewhere and think, okay, what would this look like to them? Of course, they would never see this particular thing that I'm seeing, but...
But
yeah.
I'm wondering, though, how much you really need to know about 1872 in order to pretend to be in 1872 so that it's reasonably plausible. I mean, there is nobody alive from 1872 so you can get away with murder.
And many of them are getting away with murder.
Oh, I see.
In the book.
But, I mean, it begs the question of, like, well, getting it right.
Yeah, I don't want to... I think some people who write... even thrillers and things, some of these guys who are lawyers or whatever, and they get bogged down in the minutia and you don't need to do that. And some people who've written novels set in other times also have gotten a little too bogged down. So I just made it my business to learn enough to where I could really feel. I don't know. Yeah.
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 Well, I mean, how much is enough? I'm just really curious. I mean...
I don't know, and I didn't know. Like, I tried to write this book 10 to 12 years ago, and I didn't have enough because I just couldn't get it off the ground. And so I read more books and visited more things, and
I mean, is it a matter of knowing, like, how they live, what they wear?
A little bit. To some extent, what they ate and what the toilet situation was and what the buildings were like. And, you know, it takes place in the Lower East Side. And when I first moved to the Lower East Side, it was the early 1980s, and the sense of what it was like 100 years earlier was still, wasn't very changed yet. Yeah. It's changed drastically now. And that was probably what originally sparked it. Like, I could really feel how it was to live there 100 years earlier.
Speaking of which, I want to go back to another commonality. Many of the characters in this book have brown hair, which I found to be, with the exception, of course, of the actress Ava Larkin.
Yeah.
I have a question relating to her, but I'm curious about the constant brown hair, including Joe, who has graying brown hair dripping down over his face. Why all the brown hair?
I have this thing about blonde people that I'm bad. Well, I don't care for blonde people. I'm inclined to be dismissive of blonde people. And to illustrate, there was a woman I met at an artist colony who was very much a blonde person in all ways. You know, she's very cute and very almost fluffy seeming, her personality, and I was completely dismissive of her. She was a painter, and then I saw her work, and it was spectacular.
Yeah.
And she was a really accomplished artist, and I was like, oh, I am such an asshole. And
yeah.
So that, you know, but I still have that. I don't know why. I come from a family of brown haired people, and
yeah, but you can't generalize against not all blondes.
I know. It's absurd.
One of these 1872 characters has to be a really smart blonde haired person.
I have a redhead.
Yeah. Ah.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Speaking of Ava Larkin, I actually am curious about this because the first person who popped into my mind,
yeah,
because they have the same syllables, same intonations, is Uma Thurman.
Yeah.
Who, incidentally, also happens to visit Woodstock from time to time.
Yeah.
Uma Thurman, a model for Ava Larkin, or?
I don't want to get into any kind of, I don't want Uma Thurman to get mad at me.
Oh, are you friends with Uma?
No, I'm not, but she lives in Woodstock,
yeah.
And strange things have happened to me on the trail near where she lives, and so I'll leave it at that.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah.
Including gingerbread houses?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Involving
not Uma Thurman carrying a gingerbread house,
but people carry gingerbread houses.
I did see someone carrying
it. That was so bizarre.
Yeah,
I was wondering. Wow,
it really happened. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Actually, Rikers Island.
Yeah.
You were very specific.
Yeah.
About how a character visits another character,
yeah,
in Rikers Island.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you have any personal experience going to Rikers Island, because it was very specific about like the procedure,
yeah,
what you do to get,
yeah,
in.
Yeah.
Or did you actually just call someone, or what happened?
No, I had a friend who for many years was in and out of prisons and jails, and I visited him only at the tombs. But even at the tombs, it was quite a rigmarole. And,
yeah.
And he did spend a lot of time at Rikers, and so I knew he would get mad if I didn't have it right in the book. So I called him up. I was like, okay, tell me this, this, and this. And he went through the whole thing. And so, yeah, I haven't actually visited, but I could have visited him at Rikers. I just didn't. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, I'm wondering how important it really is to get it right. I mean, you can't,
yeah,
get everything right. You're going to screw up no matter how prodigious you are.
Yeah, yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So.
Well, that one I just thought, my friend's going to get mad if it's not right. I better do it right.
So it's really like any friend who might be offended by the inaccuracy, that's really the motivating
factor?
Yeah,
oh, totally. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Raw chicken necks.
The only
food in Alice's fridge. And then later, Kimberly remarks about her aged neck didn't look too chickeny. I have never quite had nothing but chicken necks as the like last food in the fridge. So I must ask, observation, personal experience.
It's a dog thing. My dogs live on raw food, and one of the staples of a raw food diet is raw chicken necks.
Yeah.
And they're nasty. They look like shrimp. They look like giant shrimp. And so if you look in my fridge, there will be raw chicken necks. And it's just such a shocking thing to have in a character's fridge, nothing but chicken necks. I mean, I thought that's a nice touch.
Wait, so how many dogs do you have?
Well, as of a few days ago, I have just one right now, but it's a fluctuating thing, and there will be two again soon.
Because this leads me to wonder, you have 17 dogs.
No, my mom does.
Yeah. This Kimberly has 17 dogs,
yes.
Just to be clear.
Yes, yes.
Most people don't name 17 dogs over the course of a lifetime. So I must ask what the naming criteria was for this. Did you feel any particular pressure here? Because you got one of them named after the Marx Brothers, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, some were friends' dogs. I was trying to throw friends a bone, you know?
Quite literally. A chicken bone.
Yeah, a chicken neck. And some, like Ira, actually, I have a friend named Ira who thinks that dog was named after him. In fact, it was named after the guy from Yola Tango because they played a show up in Woodstock, Ira from Yola Tango. And I thought, okay, I'm going to name a dog after him.
Huh.
And I don't know, it just...
So you know a guy named Clayton too, or what?
I do.
Wow. All the character names we can find if we were to seriously investigate your life, we'd be able to find a connection?
Yeah, you actually would. Usually a lot of them are nicknames of people that I have for them and that maybe even they don't know about, but there's significance to all of it, yeah.
Huh, do you ask their permission for this? Or?
No, because none of them are really who they are in real life. You know, I just borrowed tiny bits of them. So, no, there wasn't anyone I had to ask. Except that I named a dog after a human, and I did ask him if that was all right.
But I'm wondering if any of your friends have come after you, seeing the connection, say, hey, Maggie, what the hell are you doing here?
No, not in this one, although in other books, some people were mad in my first book.
Oh,
my first book was really pretty much taken from my life. Almost verbatim, and yeah, some people got mad.
Huh. Do you ask permission if you lift certain incidents and put them into the book at all? Or?
Yeah, I kind of do now.
Oh, okay.
I do now.
And there haven't been any complaints in the last couple of books?
No, I've been good for a while now.
Okay. Have you actually played Pick Six? I mean, what's your horse racing experience?
I'm an okay handicapper and gambler, but I have a dear friend who's you know, one of the foremost in the country, and so I learned a lot through him and some friends of his, and I've tried to do it myself as a living now, and you know, because writing isn't always so lucrative. And the moment I try to do it professionally, I freeze, and I whatever talent I have for it goes out the window. I'm above average when I'm not doing it because I need the money.
Yeah.
But once I need the money,
yeah,
doesn't work.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Interesting. I also wanted to ask you about the soundtrack of Dog Toenails Against Wood Floors. Did you say that's worse than the soundtrack of, say, Fingers on a Chalkboard, or?
Oh no, it's a little more musical than that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's a. Yeah.
I also want to ask you about, you're often fond of internal rhyme in your sentences, particularly with two words together like bactacatas.
Uh-huh.
And I'm curious, do you pay attention to how often you have an internal rhyme scenario with two words? Or,
I don't pay attention to it, but it comes from having started as a spoken word person. I'm kind of in my head hearing it, and it's music. And so I'm not aware of it, but it just comes naturally to me.
To what extent do you have to resist certain musical impulses if you have to keep the story moving forward?
I haven't had to. I mean, yeah, I haven't. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I wanted to also ask you about Kimberly's vomiting. It seemed to me to represent something, and then there is a development later on.
Yeah.
This may be the first novel I've read in which vomiting serves as a MacGuffin. Was this intended from the
yeah,
get-go?
Yeah, yeah, it was, yeah.
Yeah, we need more bodily MacGuffins, basically.
Yeah.
where did the accident-prone scenario with Eloise come
from?
Yeah. Falling into the manhole?
I don't know. I just have always liked really clumsy people. I'm mildly clumsy, but I don't even know anyone who's as clumsy as Eloise is. And accident-prone. But I just thought it was kind of charming that she's this stunningly beautiful woman who doesn't really know she's stunningly beautiful. I like that. And is incredibly accident-prone.
Yeah. Do you actually know a gentleman named Rotten? Aside from, of course, Johnny Rotten.
No, I don't.
Yeah. That would have been my clue if I were possibly dating someone named Rotten, that maybe not exactly the world's best
potential mate.
Yes. Kimberly hasn't gone on vacation since 1989.
Yeah.
Does this relate to her medical condition? Is it... have you been on vacation since...
I have,
Okay.
I went in March.
Oh,
I
okay.
went to Mexico.
You're doing better than Kimberly.
Yeah, I am. Yeah, yeah,
okay.
yeah.
What other crazy questions do I have?
I know. Look at these crazy questions.
Actually, I wanted to ask you about this. Kimberly is initially charmed by Bettina's tendency to translate German to English.
Yeah.
Before speaking, structuring her sentences in strange ways.
Yeah.
How did this come up? I mean, this was a very odd form of attraction. And then she gets sick of it.
Yeah.
Was this kind of a way for you to disrupt the dialogue at this point? Or?
I had a German boyfriend and a similar, and he was very, very smart guy, and who would be translating in his head to speak English, and his sentences would be backwards. And it was, I mean, yeah, this is a simple case of taking it from my own life. At first, it was really charming and magical. He'd end up making these crazy sentences that were beautiful, and by the end, it was just annoying.
Wow.
So yeah, I just lifted that directly.
Presume this boyfriend is not a boyfriend anymore.
No, he's not.
Okay.
He's still a friend, though.
That's good.
Yeah,
that's good.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of the three first-person perspectives, which we haven't even talked about, to what degree did you set specific rules so that you would ensure that they would be all separate and distinct?
Yeah.
I mean, there's some similarities in terms of like how they relate to the world, because, of course, they all have to share the same blood. I'm curious if you laid any ground rules to, you know, little things that you did to make them.
I had to go back, actually. Alice and Eloise were a little too similar, and I had to go back and think about them and just carve them out a little bit. You know, I had to make Alice a little even tougher and more borderline sociopathic than she was, and I had to make Eloise more tender.
Yeah.
Because they were kind of blurring. The mother was always pretty much a distinct entity.
Yeah. But also going back to, you know, the symmetry I was talking about earlier about being kicked out of bed. Obviously you had to make specific choices that were totally 180 from, you know, both the sisters in this case being totally 180 from each other.
Yeah.
But also sharing similarities. So, maybe a better question is, going back to the vomiting as MacGuffin, how much of the details were introduced at the particular time they were introduced, and you thought to yourself, oh, well, here's a great way to throw off the reader? I mean, do you believe in tricking the reader at every possibility, or?
No, I don't, again, I'm not sure if I even knew what was going to happen with the mother when I first had her vomiting. I don't remember, I think maybe I did, but I'm not even sure if I knew, so... No, I don't want to trick the reader so much. The only thing, you know, I devour stacks of you know, crime fiction, and so I've almost run out of things to read, and so I started reading Ruth Rendell, who I actually like her quite a bit, and she does this great thing in one of the books I read recently where you're with this character throughout the book, and you know a great deal about him. And only in something like the last page does she tell you that character's black, and you realize, oh, all this time I assumed the character was white, and I thought that was a nice trick, and so I want to do that too.
Yeah, but I mean, to some degree, when you trick a reader, the reader may feel manipulated, or maybe you might. Do you feel any guilt for anything like that at the same time?
I just thought it was an interesting. It made me look at my assumptions, and I thought that's a nice trick for an author to play on its reader. I mean, I'm not into tricking my readers. I just want to, you know, cheer them up. Actually,
yeah. Kate Thompson wrote books based off of a character named Eloise.
Uh-huh.
And that Eloise, I'm not sure if you've read them,
no.
But that Eloise had a pug dog as well.
Oh.
So I found that. I wanted to ask if there was any possible similarity there.
No.
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 I'm trying to think of a good question to end this. I guess I'll just say, Maggie, with that in mind, thanks so much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
You're welcome.
Okay.
And sorrow. Death is too drastic, I can't say goodbye. Golden or plastic, the joys of tomorrow. Life is fantastic, I don't want to die.